Blog Talk Radio.
This is Jeanette Parker from Medical Whistleblower, and we're happy to hear you and have you here on the show. We have Cindy Fisher with us today, and this is Medical Whistleblower from Lawrence, Kansas, and we are here to highlight a human rights issue today, the issue of forced psychiatric drugging. And Cindy is joining us from Washington State, and she is a concerned mother. Cindy, do you want to tell us a little bit about your situation?
Yes, I'd be glad to, Jeanette. I live in the state of Washington, and I have four adult children, and my oldest is 35, and he is the one that has helped me to become aware of the abuse, exploitation, and experimentation that happens within psychiatric units where there is forced institutionalization. He was, I guess I could just start in with the story of how my son into the system, Jeanette. Is that?
Yes, I'm sure. That's always our audience want to hear that.
Okay, and I'm not sure if, now I just heard a call coming in, and I don't know how to block my calls. I don't know if that shows up. Did you hear that beep, and does that disturb your program?
No,
okay, good. Good, that's good to hear. So my story starts with my son who, he was a precocious young man. At age 12, he won the Washington State Chess Championship in sixth grade. And in seventh grade, he was chosen through a John Hopkins University kind of contest to find the gifted and talented in each state. And so my son was selected to take the SAT, and at age 13, he scored in the top 25% of college-bound high school seniors. So he had that stream of intelligence, and also he had, a very extreme sensitivity and awareness of right and wrong and justice. So shortly after taking the SAT, he actually ran away from home. His father was a pharmacist, who he's no longer living now. I was a teacher, and we were in that upward mobility track of get ahead, get all of the things that Americans should have. And my son, like many young adults his age, 13, 14, 15, and on up to, I'd say, 20, 21, they can see clearly when things don't seem to really fit in the scope of what's true humanity and true justice. And he really wasn't interested in the becoming the great all-American achiever. He ran away. He came back 3 months later. I kind of knew of his whereabouts, but because the home life was kind of rocky, his father and I had different ideas on how to raise children. And when he came back on my birthday, he shared with me about living life on the streets. And I remember to this day the tears that came down his eyes when he said, "Mother," he said, "America throws away its young and its old people." And that was the sense of frustration and outrage that this young 13-year-old young man who was African-American and in a mostly all-white community held. And with that outrage, he tried to change our society. And consequently, he was broken by a society that had no need for anyone who wasn't going to conform and move ahead and up the ranks. He did develop a psychosis, which I now believe is just a normal reaction to extreme expressions of whatever, whether frustration, outrage, pain. It's the body's way of saying things are not right. And if there is not a support and help to surround a person that has gotten to the point where their body is traumatized and their mind becomes affected, things just get worse. And unfortunately, in our society, looking back, and I didn't realize this at the time, but looking back, I realized that there is a void there, that if our young adults could get the immediate support and immersed in the type of care and hearing and understanding and listening and direction that they needed, I believe we wouldn't have the level of what they call juvenile or schizophrenia onset at puberty. But because we have nothing there except maybe an hour a week of counseling, if we're lucky, if you have insurance, and that counseling is usually for the individual. It's not in the context of, yes, you do live in a society that is really quite insane or quite violent or quite racist. But it's more like, what can we do to you to help you figure out how to fit in? So with that kind of counseling is the limitation on what someone who is in an extreme state of distress, with that kind of limited consultation, most cases of psychosis go from bad to worse. And you really nowadays can't get help until the psychosis has gotten to the place where the acts are going to be criminalized. Whether it's an act against oneself or an act against someone else, it's only at that point that you can get help. And with my son, we got help from a psychiatrist. He was at age 17, and I was desperate, although I didn't believe in psychiatrists for a long time in mental health hospitals. Nothing else seemed to be working. He kept getting worse, like one would expect one to do with a psychosis without help. And I just assumed my son was going crazy. I took the advice of the psychiatrist that we referred to. He agreed to take the medication. There was no informed consent whatsoever. She just gave me this prescription to go and fill, and we were to return in 2 weeks. I later found out, almost 15 years later, that this prescription that she gave me was the maximum adult dose for my son, who was a 17-year-old adolescent, and that would make it 1,200% above the recommended dosage for his age. And so in the next 6 months, when he began self-harming behaviors, extremely self-harming behaviors, like giving himself a 6-by-3-inch burn on the arm, by giving himself artificial cuts with a razor blade on his wrist, by having an extreme fear that he was going to jump out of the second-story window where his bedroom was, when these things all happened, I was told they were just manifestations of his illness. Only many years later did I understand that they were manifestations of the drug dosages that he was given. And
can you give us the name of the drug that he was on?
It was risperidol. And if you read the side effects, the risperidol will say things like it causes increased agitation, it causes suicidal thoughts, like my son wanting to jump out of the window. It causes a numbing of one's feelings and one's experiences. My son said he gave himself that 6-by-3-inch third-degree burn because he wanted to feel something, and that burn allowed him to feel something. So, and these were not symptoms that he had exhibited prior. He had psychosis, he had hallucinations, he had delusions, but he was not doing self-harming behaviors. And as often happens with young folks who are on these drugs, the behaviors get to the point where they become criminalized, and that will cause the person to go into the criminal justice system when indeed it was a drug-induced behavior. My son experienced in the 6 month of being drugged, and again, I'm still giving him the drugs because I've been told that it's his illness that's making him do all these strange things. So in the 6 month, he experienced an extreme toxic I call it poisoning, but that may not be the correct word. But that was his description when he later recounts what he was experiencing. His whole inside of his body felt like it was on fire. And he felt that his parents had poisoned him. So he left the home early in the morning, about 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning, to get help because he was dying from this being on fire inside. And we lived in an almost all-white neighborhood, and he has a big afro, and he's tall, and he fits the description that they have so often of black people, and they want you to be scared of him. He's really, in our culture, he's a very handsome, tall young man with a beautiful afro, but our culture has, you know, so denigrated the African-American as the gangster. So he's knocking on his door in the morning trying to get help. Nobody answers. He goes to the next door. He knocks louder. At this point, he says his head is feeling like a jackhammer. His insides are peeling on fire. So he goes to the third door, and desperate because nobody's answering, he does actually a very logical thing to save his life, what someone would do to try to get help when no help seemed to be present. So he takes a stick and he breaks the picture window of the house and then walks to the neighborhood street right in front of the house, which is a small street, and sits in the middle of the street waiting for that help that he so desperately needs so that he won't die from this poisoning. When the police arrive, because of course someone does call the police at this point, there are two police reports. And again, this is typical of often what happens when police want to make their case solid. One police report said exactly what my son said in the hospital report, where he ended up going a few months later because of this incident. When they arrived, he said, "I'm dying from being poisoned." Now, mind you, he's collapsed. He's sitting on the ground. He's in agony, and he's telling them, "I'm dying from being poisoned. Please take me to the hospital." And that's what the police report says. The other police report says that there was a neighbor holding him down until the police arrived. But there's no mention of the neighbor's name, and the neighbor is never mentioned in another report, a hospital report, a court report, or anything. So, and indeed, I think my son's story was the true story, that he sat and waited for help. And as happens so many times, especially with young men of color, and in particular African-American men, he is surrounded, read his rights, and he's taken to the jail. In book for first it was malicious mischief, and then the prosecuting attorney bumps the charge up to burglary, because any time any kind of an object or body crosses the line from into someone's house, it's considered burglary. There's no consideration given to the fact that he's experiencing extreme toxic poisoning, you know, or that he's there waiting, asking to be taken to the hospital. All of that is just glanced over. I, just in shock, immediately went down and bailed him out. I got him out the next day. And in my ignorance and in the fact that there's a void out there, I thought, I've got to get him treated in a hospital. He hadn't been in a hospital yet. He had just been taking the drugs. I thought he had been getting worse and worse, not knowing it was the drugs. So I took him into the belly of the beast, as I see it now, to be treated. When I read these hospital reports now, which are almost 17 years ago, they gave him a shot of Halidol, which gave him a malignant syndrome reaction. It means the muscles got extremely tense and painful. He was overdosed on these drugs. So then they had to give him something else. I think it was Prolixin. One was Halidol and one was Prolixin. One was supposed to counteract the other. I don't know exactly which came first there. I do know that the...
Can we move forward a little bit?
Sure.
As we have just 15 minutes left. Is your son now, and why are you protesting at this point?
So my son has cycled in and out of the state hospital from actions that are usually bizarre behavior, where he may wander into somebody's house or in broad daylight when they're there, and this is while he's on or shortly after taking neuroleptic drugs. And so his most current stay in the hospital, he's been there 16 times. This last time he violated a no trespassing order. He wasn't supposed to return to this restaurant. Went there, they asked him to leave. He left, he went back to his place where he was staying. The police came and picked him up to tell him he violated no trespassing. He spit at them, so that was considered a felony. Went to jail. They said he was incompetent to stand trial, and they sent him up to Western State, ended up dropping all the charges without prejudice, which means they could bring them back up. And they have supposedly been treating him to get better, but they haven't done any treatment in the last 17 times that he's been there that deals with the trauma that he told them, and it's on the records. If you get his records now, the first time he went to Western State Hospital, he shared, because he believed he was in a hospital and that they could maybe really help, he shared four extreme traumatic events in his life, and they were just totally glossed over it. So that's never been dealt with. And every time he goes to the hospital, he's almost always given the maximum or double the maximum dose of Geodon, Risperidol, whatever the drug of the day is that I think they can get the most money. And there's never any trauma-informed care. So when he comes out, he's been traumatized in what feels like a prison. He doesn't feel like it's a hospital. It doesn't feel like it's helping him. He always begs to get out. It's never, Mom, this place is helping me. I want to stay here. And so I've been fighting to get him out. He had a 180-day commitment. He did what he was supposed to do. We started discharge plans back in September, but they said he couldn't be discharged to my house because he's too dangerous. But they keep giving him the medication that causes him to be dangerous. And then they say they can't find a place for him. So since September, we've been looking for, I'm trying to convince them, here's a place. And they keep saying no, no. So much so that the 180 days ran out. My son actually walked away from the hospital because he knew his 180 days were up and he knew that he should be able to go home, and he asked for a weekend pass and they denied him. And he was able to live freely for a week before they took him back, found him. But here we are. October 19th was 180 days. They asked for another 180. They said, well, we don't think we'll keep him that long at all, just a couple of months until we find a place. But that's like, we're up to, almost February 19th, which is 4 months later. So we're almost up into the 180 days again. So I've done, with moms in the summer, I did a 100-mile walk with some other moms who have experienced this same extreme, we feel it's torture, exploitation, abuse in the psychiatric institutions, and our voices have been shut down, and when we try to raise them, they shut us out. Right now, I'm under a gag order that I can't talk to anybody. Should I call my son and another patient answers? I always talk to them, ask how they're doing, should they be there. I want to know if they, you know, feel like they're being treated well. And I actually helped expose someone who had been put up there unjustly. And through his conversation with me, he was out within 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. But I've been told that I can't visit my son until I sign this paper, this gag order that says that I can't talk with anyone on the phone. And when I visit my son, because sometimes if I move to Seattle, I'm there every other day, so the patients who don't get visitors are happy to see a smiling face, that happy to see them. I get to know them by name. They'll sneak into the room where my son and I are visiting, and they'll start talking to me and my son. But this is something that they don't want. They call it protection of patients' privacy. But to me, these patients are desperate for outside help. They tell me they feel like they're prisoners. They tell me that they don't like the medication. They tell me all kinds of things. And I'm supposed to say when they come up to me, oh, no, I can't talk to you. Go away. Go away. I can't talk to you. I must not smile. I must not ask you how you're doing. And I refuse to sign the gag order. So I have been refused visitations with my son.
So you recently did a hunger strike, and we...
I did.
What were you hopeful of attaining with the hunger strike?
Well, you know, I think one of the number one things was to embolden, encourage others to be willing to step up and act. My parents, many of my parents are so fearful that they'll be cut off completely from their children, which, as you can see, it did happen to me, so it's a real fear in some ways. But it's only as we stand together and expose them and demand, you know, what are basic human rights and constitutional rights, that we'll be able to make a difference. So I did it both to embolden myself and my parents, and we're having a rally on my son's birthday, whether he's out or not. Hopefully he'll be there. But in front of the courthouse, I want...
What day is that?
This is on February 28th, Thursday, in Clark County, Vancouver, Washington, from noon to 1. It's actually a rally and a vigil. It's a vigil for two young adults in Vancouver. One young woman, 4 days after her 20th birthday, hung herself at Western State Hospital. And I write about that on my website, mentalhealthrightsyes.org. It's like she got a pill for her pain. Instead of arms, she got straps to tie her to her bed, instead of arms to wrap around and hold her while she cried. And then another young man who had some mental illness symptoms was killed in our jail. The four guards say that they were trying to keep him from committing suicide, and yet in that act, they took his life. So we're having a vigil for them, and then a rally for mental health care transformation. We want to take mental health care out of the psychiatric and pharmaceutical industry realm, bring it into the communities, and begin to create communities where the hearts can heal. We have so much happening in our communities that all of us are going to be have and will be experiencing signs of distress and duress, and there's less and less governmental systems out there to help us, and the ones that are out there to control our lives. We have to give up our freedoms and our human rights in order to get help, and I'm saying that we as a community can come together and learn how to support each other and be with each other in crisis early on, so it doesn't become this full-fledged intense crisis that's going to cause a lot of us distress. And I just want to say very quickly, I just finished a workshop Sunday with a process called Open Dialogue, which started in Lapland, Finland. And in Lapland, Finland, they have the best recovery rate for schizophrenia in the world, and they are looked at and thoroughly researched by the best psychiatric experimenters in the world. And there's no question, hands down, that they've developed this dialogue, and medication is minimized. And what is even more amazing, they have found that because they deal with the first episode immediately of schizophrenia, they go to the house and bring in all the social networks of that person, and they're there with that person for the next, it could be 1 or 2 or 3 years, they don't live with them, but they're there for them. They have actually found that the rate of schizophrenia is going down because one cannot be labeled as a person with schizophrenia unless you've had the symptoms for 6 months. So because they immediately respond to that crisis, many of these cases that would become full-blown schizophrenia diagnosis, they don't get that point because they won't get up to the 6 months of having those symptoms. And to me, that is just so heartwarming and refreshing. And yet,
real quickly, because we're running out of time, what would you wish be for your son and yourself at this point?
I want my son free from the hospital and given the financial support and the power of choice and voice, along with his chosen social network, to help recover from those traumatic events that never were dealt with and that have been compounded by being forced, injected with drugs, forced hospitalized, imprisoned. All of that is added on to the trauma. So to have the support, financial, and the freedom to allow him to help direct the direction of his recovery would be
a good wish to have for your son.
And it's his birthday that we're doing the rally, February 28th.
And what day is that?
Thursday, February 28th.
February 28th. And I want to thank everyone for listening to us here on Medical Whistleblower, Blog Talk Radio. We're coming to you live today from Lawrence, Kansas. And this is Dr. Jeanette Parker. I work with human rights issues in medicine. And we, of course, support informed care for trauma victims, and also compassionate care for persons who have mental health concerns. And do you want to direct them to your website?
Yes. My website is mentalhealthrights, RIGHTS, and then the word yes, YES.org. I will say that since I posted some pretty damning information about Western State, that I'm having trouble getting information on my website. So it might not talk about the hunger strike right now because I couldn't get that information back up once I took it down to re-edit it. But keep coming back to it because I will persist. I am determined, and where there's a will, there's a way.
And you did do a hunger strike for how many days?
I did a 16-day hunger strike, and I lost 17 pounds. And in the summer, two moms and I did a 100-mile walk to Western State Hospital, and that was successful because one of the moms that met us there, her son hadn't been able to talk for 6 months because of the drugging, and after we pointed that out to the CEO, within 2 weeks he was talking again.
So a change in medication did make a difference for him.
Yeah.
Well,
Public pressure.
Thank you all for listening to us today at Blog Talk Radio, and I thank you, Mrs. Cindy Fisher, for joining
thank
us
you, Jeanette,
and sharing the story of your son, Siddhartha, with us and with our audience. And again, I want to thank everyone for tuning in today to Medical Whistleblower Advocacy Network Blog Talk Radio Show. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeanette. Are we off?
We're off.